top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
Strange case. No sign of violence, yet she looks completely contorted in fear. Almost as if she'd been frightened to death. As if she'd seen something too horrible to live through.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more. From our downtown Toronto headquarters, House, from 1986.
86?
I believe so.
I wrote down 85.
Not sure, but this is hot on the heels of another New World production, which was Chud. Mm-hmm. We're in similar territory and a similar movie insofar as the poster, Out of This World. I have mis-memory of having seen it, did not, but that poster is this desiccated zombie digit pointing at a doorbell, like one of the all-time greats, another one that I remember growing up distinctly.
It's just, you know, it's funny because, I don't know, I don't know if people have these experiences anymore that you and I and other people that have our vintage got to share. Nowadays, newspapers are, well, they're not dead, but they're on life support, right? Mm-hmm. If you want to believe the man who's president of the United States, I decided to stop saying his name. He's Voldemort to me. They're all failing. The failing New York Times, blah, 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 right? But New York Times is not fucking failing, okay? But...
Well, newspapers have been sort of on the decline for 20 years.
Yeah, of course they have.
He's
been.
Not like... a sage to point out that
he's also got a dick that looks like Toad and Mary Kart, apparently, according to Stormy Daniels in her later memoir. Do you know what Toad looks like in Mary Kart?
Oh yes,
not a pretty sight
because of Twitter. Yes,
and she also described his pubes as being yeti like or
yeti.
So yeah, very topical in the Really Awful Movies podcast talking about the president's genitalia.
Yes,
but anyhow, as a kid, one of the things I used to love doing was grabbing that newspaper, that big ass heavy plop when it was dropped on the front porch, and I would pull it in on a Friday because Friday was when the new movies would open always. Now you got these Wednesday release days, special sneak preview Thursday. Bullshit, I hate it. It was always on Friday. That was the movie day, right? And then the first thing I would go to is the entertainment section, and I would leaf through, you know, skip past the articles and just go right to the posters. And just look at the posters for the movies that were playing already in the cinema, the ones I could see, the ones I couldn't see, because obviously I was too young. But it was just like, it was like going to the MoMA. I was just enthralled by what I was seeing. And so, yeah, I would see this desiccated finger pointing at the doorbell for the movie House, which I did not see in the 80s. I did see it subsequently, but of course... this was a movie I could have seen in the 80s. Like Chud, this is what you would call an entry-level horror. Child-like horror, you know what I mean? Or at least child-friendly horror. It's not overtly gruesome or gory. It's more fun. We'll get into more. But what I'm saying to you is that just that act of being able to look at these posters and imagine, that's another thing too, using your imagination. Because if you can't see a movie, so for example, you see a poster for something along the lines of Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3, The Dream Warriors, right? There was no way in hell that I was going to be allowed to see that movie. Not that I even wanted to at the time, because I was too afraid to. But you imagine things. You saw this visage. You saw this burnt visage. You saw this hat. You saw this claw coming. You saw these kids at the bottom. You're like, what the heck? So you built the movie up in your head, you know? Sometimes, to satiate myself, because I couldn't go see an R-rated movie in the cinema, I would read the novelization.
Uh-huh.
And that would satiate me until I can actually see the movie. Sometimes the novelizations were better than the actual movie because they included scenes that were not in the movie. Anyway, I digress. But that's another thing that is lost on today's movie going public, is just being able to page through the entertainment section of the newspaper and look at the posters. They don't have posters anymore.
No.
They just have listings. That's it.
Yeah, I would dive into the entertainment section as well, because that therein was wrapped tightly Star Week, which is a version of TV Guide, and I would do the same thing for late night movies that possibly I might not be able to rent, but that I could maybe sneak up late and watch. And these were ones that were featured on our city TV and whatnot. They would air typically at 12 and 2. And without, this is without prejudice, like you get in a thumbnail on Netflix, because of their algorithms, they suggest movies for you in a way that you were your own actor back in the day. You knew what you liked based on a poster. You weren't given things that someone or some bot thought you would like. Mm-hmm. And then worse is a star rating, which prejudices me as well when I'm on Netflix. If I see something with one star and it's a natural horror, I'm not going to probably be invested in that because it's going to be bad.
I read recently that Netflix is getting rid of the star rating system because they found that people don't heed it. They watch what they want to watch, and that's the end of that. So
I think I will heed it on the tail ends of the distribution. Mm-hmm. So 5, yes, I'm going to watch it. 1, no, I'm not. But 2, 3, I'm sort of, 2 is a meh. I think any movie should be able to get a 2 and a 1. That's a special, special case.
But are you one of these people who then, after watching a movie, you actually include your own rating?
Never.
You don't do it.
I don't know why. Maybe I just don't feel like helping Netflix, especially since why would I want some quid pro quo arrangement with some piece of shit service that is screwing us as Canadians?
Mm.
But that's another. We could devote an entire podcast to our antipathy toward Netflix.
Well, you know, it's interesting because we got off on a little tangent, but that's great because that's one of the things about our podcast. We're very tangential, but we always return back to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And when you made your intro and talked about House from 86, 85, doesn't matter. I was going to say, of course, not to be confused with the Japanese film Houseu from 1977, which is one of my absolute favorite films, which I wrote about in our book, Death by Umbrella, The 100 Weirdest Weapons. There are actually 3 unique weapons in that one that I put into the same essay. Yeah. That was one of my proudest essays in the book. Some of them I'm prouder than others, of course. I'm sure you are too, with the ones you wrote. Because when that film was released stateside, it was just, Houseu directly translates to House. And when Criterion put it out, I believe they put it out under, I'm fairly certain under the American title, although they might, knowing Criterion, they probably did use the Japanese title. Doesn't matter. It's amazing. It's one word. It's one syllable, right? It's a word that everybody knows. And yet, in the context of horror, it's so evocative, especially when you have so many movies that take place in purportedly haunted houses, you know, like your Amityville Horrors and whatnot, your Burnt Offerings, or your... I mean, even if the whole house isn't haunted, the house is loom large in films such as Psycho, right? It's not a haunted house, but there's shit going on there that ain't right. The last house on the left. Whatever. The word house is so imbued with connotation in the world of horror that goes beyond just a denotation of a place where you live, right? And so when you hear house, you just think, wow, something amiss is happening. See, because the connotation of house is very different from home, right? The denotation is they're both the same thing, right? They're dwellings. They're where you live, right? But house is... The connotation is very, very different. That's what the word makes you feel, right? If this movie was called Home...
It could be another genre as well. Yeah. Something, yeah.
Yeah, it'd be like a sitcom. Home, you know? Home is something that has this wonderful connotation. Family, security, warmth. Whereas house is just an edifice. It's a structure. Nobody ever says, oh my God, I'm having a rough day, I'm not feeling good, I can't wait to go house. No. They want to go home, right?
Yeah.
But in the world of horror, the connotation for house is very different. And again, one more thing about not confusing, this is not House MD. Is that what you're going to say?
No. Okay. Maybe, yeah, the Blackadder star, that, you know, one wonderful show.
I've not seen one episode.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, on a more pedestrian level, that what inspired this... was partly your own domestic domesticity.
I'm like, why is Chris bringing this up?
Well, you know, as the phrase goes, a friend helps you move, a good friend helps you move a body. Well, there are no bodies around a couple weeks back, but you gathered a couple of your best mates to help you move. So we are in a different space. And I was thinking also when you're talking about connotations and denotations of house and home, of personal space, which I always thought was weird, like, don't get into my personal space, like a Seinfeld close talker. But a personal space is not you walking around. This is a personal space. Mm-hmm. Like, I look around and there's Wonder Woman on top of your computer lassoing. Like, there's a statuette, a foot-high statuette, and that's amazing.
Rick,
like,
and Morty right there.
Like, I could guess whose place this belonged to out of all my friends just by that.
Yeah.
And that's amazing. Yeah, and there's these, like, touchstones of these iconography and tchotchkes. You know, that's probably a pejorative, but...
No,
just,
not at all.
Vincent Price right here, and, like, Lon Chaney and Christopher Lee, mm-hmm. and just all this stuff that makes this place uniquely yours.
And even though I've made a conscious decision to put out less stuff to declutter it, as opposed to my old domicile where it was quite cluttered with lots and lots of trash keys, which is not pejorative at all, you definitely still is a good representation of myself. Okay, so yeah, why did I have to move houses? Because over the summer my marriage crumbled. I can't say I'm divorced, because in Canada you have to be separated for 1 year before you can file for divorce. Did you know this, Chris?
No. Yeah. That is amazing.
So our official date of separation was May 20th. And we are officially separated. We went to the lawyers, we got the separation documents, made, paid for, cost a fortune, notarized, signed, and triplicate, duplicate, what have you. This was done very hastily before we left for England, because my ex now wanted it done before I left. Came back, she was still there, even though she had pulled the trigger and said that she wanted the marriage to be over. It was a very interesting summer. I mean, my marriage dissolved. I had to sell our downtown Toronto headquarters because...
I was going to say, at least the structure of that was not crumbling like the marriage.
It was the marital home, and, you know, I couldn't afford to buy her out, even though I didn't want to move. And then I had to find a new place to live. Now, it's interesting because we're talking about connotation and denotation and so on and so forth, and we're supposed to talk about the movie House, and we will get into it. Just keep on listening. But I do recall... Because you would come by to record, and of course my ex was there, and you would hang out with, you'd always chat with her. It's amicable, we're still friendly, we still talk on the phone every now and again. And I remember you came by to record when I was in the process of packing up, and there really wasn't anything in my home other than boxes. And you actually said, and this kind of hurt me a little bit, you said, this place is no longer a home, right? Mm. And that... hurt me, because I thought you said it's no longer home because Tony's no longer there, right? But I think what you meant was, and it's sort of like it hit me because of the fact of what I've lost.
Yeah.
But was it because my significant other wasn't there? It's because the stuff that was so identifiably me wasn't there.
Or the stuff that was identifiably both of you wasn't there. Yeah, even though your stuff, I guess, outnumbered hers by a factor of about 5-1.
When we moved in, we said, okay, we're going to decorate this place 50-50, but I right away started encroaching, and there was encroaching.
Yeah.
And 50-50 became 60-40, became 80-20, so yeah, I had a lot of stuff to pack up.
But that's weird, though, because in the horror movie sphere, in the milieu, it's usually somebody who's out of home, and... going to occupy a dwelling that has its own that becomes its own character. I mean, there are certainly there are homes that are their own characters that are inhabited by people, but more often than not, it's the someone who is seeking solace or seclusion.
The changeling.
We talked with the wonderful Scott Drebbit from Daily Dead, Burnt Offerings, with Oliver Reed, and that's a guy. It's like, oh sure, I'm going to take over this ramshackle house with my family for the summer and see what happens. A la The Shining.
Another
same
film
thing.
That you seem to you really enjoy. I don't like very much. Sinister.
Sinister, I enjoy. Yeah, I guess I prefer the dislocation of place that comes from you occupying a place that isn't yours. And I think the movies tend to be better as well when someone occupies a new space, that because it's novelty, I think.
Well,
it's easier to scare someone when you set up the scares of a new place.
That's sort of what's going on here, because it's not his house. It's his aunt's house. She passes, and he opts, our protagonist, to live there. But before that, I just wanted to go back, and you were talking about me assembling my good friends helped me move. And I would say that it was an interesting day, wasn't it? It was a hot day.
We had a few
snacks.
Maybe
the hottest day of the year.
Yeah. Three of my friends helped me. They all worked their asses off, present company included. One of them, he was sort of useless. We're not going to name names.
Yeah,
but
yeah, we know who you are.
Yeah, you know who it is. But Chris was, I could have done it without you. So thank you.
No,
and yes, I've been here now in my new residence for, I'd say, just over a month. And it took me a while to feel at home. It was for a long time. It's not a house. It's a condo. But now it feels mine. At first, I had too little out. I was like, I want to keep it minimalist. And then I just wasn't feeling at home. So I'm like, you know what? I got to put up more stuff. So without going overboard, I added another picture of Vincent. I put up that Montiglione Reaper over there, etc. Some stuff in my bedroom, which you're not going to see because I'm not going to let you into my bedroom. That's my private space, whatever. Either way, now I feel at home. So in horror, house means everything. So it amazes me that it took so long, not until the mid-80s, for somebody to actually come out with a movie and tell the house.
Oh, for sure.
You know?
And this house is quite impressive as well. Like, it's the typical, I mean, my God, I don't know if this was a thing, maybe it was the location, but this, to me, looks like a bit of the Psycho House, a bit of the House on Haunted Hill. It's the sprawling West Coast Victorian mansion. And it's the same setup, seemingly every time. And what a great house. And a la The Shining. Yeah, and the protagonist occupying the house is the great, wonderfully named Roger Cobb, which sounds like a porn nom de plume if there ever was one.
Played by American here himself, William Catt.
Yeah, and he's a famous novelist.
Also was in Carrie. So.
He was indeed. He's a famous novelist. What does a writer need to spur his craft for inspiration? You need solitude, and he actually expresses this to one of his neighbors. He needs solitude. He needs seclusion. And he occupies the house... formerly
occupied by his aunt, who in the early moments of the film passes
wonderful
on.
Wonderful prelude.
Well, wonderful prelude. First of all, I gotta tell you one thing. This film has a very heavy Friday the 13th connection. Maybe you're saving that for What Did You Learn, but...
Oh yeah, well, I mean, Steve Miner and Sean S. Cunningham
right.
were behind this, so...
And it's interesting, because when the film begins, it feels like a slasher. Just the way the camera moves... You know, almost like a character unto itself, panning through the home, all these long shots, almost POV in a sense, the ominous music, and this is sort of establishing the house as a character to itself, and then we meet the denizen of the home, the aunt, who is ready, about to off herself.
Yeah.
But it feels like a slasher, but then it sort of takes a turn into another sort of type of film, which we'll talk about as we continue. But yeah. As you were saying.
Well, no, I thought that was really evocative and interesting, and maybe just because I have a somewhat, personal connection to someone who hung themselves, and I feel that that's, I find that just a really shocking and really in your face and really, really disturbing way to do it. And
do you know what, dude? I don't know. When it comes to suicide, I don't think...
There's no good way, but, I was thinking about that with Anthony Bourdain as well, but I mean, seeing someone, especially the way they depicted it here, someone swinging to and fro, there's something so jarring about that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of horror preludes are super cheesy, as we've discussed in the podcast, ad nauseum, maybe with Hospital Massacre, etc. This one was really cool.
I love how every time you
that is one of the greatest ones. Yeah, that's a great prologue.
Prologue, prelude,
tomato, tomato.
Because it telegraphs the entire film right there.
Yeah,
there,
but this almost reminded me of, I mean, similar in a way to When a Stranger Calls, because you have this setup of something that you think is going to take you somewhere, and then you're taken somewhere else. And I would say, similarly to that film, not necessarily for the better, and then it picked up again later on, but...
Okay, this is a film... It's a haunted house film. He moves in...
Roger Cobb.
Roger Cobb. He moves in... Weird shit starts happening...
That's sort of like Cobbler's Knob from Groundhog Day.
But, so... you know, there's no point in delving too deep in the plot. What I just wrote down is Evil Dead 2 type shenanigans ensue. Because that's what it was, exactly. Right? All of a sudden,
oh my
like,
god,
you know,
yeah,
this great
winged skull attacks him
at
some point.
And,
yeah,
you know, this mounted bass, you know, large mouth bass starts talking, and that's what it is. If you like that Evil Dead sort of slapstick shenanigans in your horror, you're going to get it here. You're going to get these great, great practical monstrosities attacking him and so on. That is effective or ineffective depending upon your exposure to that or your affinity for that sort of horror.
Yeah.
But there's things going on in this movie that I do appreciate. Because Cobb's experiences, you know, we always talk about the unreliable narrator and so on. Cobb has a wife. Is she his ex-wife? Is she still his wife? We don't even know because he keeps flashing back and forth.
Almost
in so
like
many
your
ways.
Situation. Little did I know with weird intricacies of Canadian legal jurisprudence here.
Yeah, so yeah, that's the whole thing. By the way, just getting back to that, many couples don't even file for divorce. Once they separate and the agreement is done, that's that. They only need to file for divorce because you have to pay a fee of like $800 if you want to get remarried.
Oh my God.
I don't plan to ever get remarried, ergo I may never file for divorce.
Well, you're still wearing a shirt, so far so good, I guess. So okay. You haven't lost your shirt.
It's a tank top. Okay, it's halfway lost. You know, I lost my sleeves. Getting back to that, so his wife, ex-wife, what have you, is played by Kay Lenz, who I must admit I only know from Roger Corman produced the wonderful Straight to Kill, where she plays the cop that goes undercover in a strip club as a stripper. Her partner is Greg Evigan from My Two Dads. What a wonderful wacky movie. But anyway,
that's coming.
What's interesting though is that Cobb is a Vietnam vet and he keeps on having flashbacks over and over again, not just his marriage, not just what may have happened to his son, but to his time in Vietnam. He's wrestling with something. And in the mid 80s when this film came out, America was still wrestling with the aftermath of the Vietnam War, because hey, that was the first war they lost, right? And you have a lot of revisionist history, like Rambo.
I'd like to throw in the War of 1812, too, to throw in a Canadian plug for another war they lost. We burned down the White House in 1812.
Yes, we did. And according to President Voldemort, our Prime Minister Trudeau did it himself. You know what that brilliant man said today? What's the name of that hurricane?
Florence.
He was asked about the hurricane. This hurricane is unprecedented in scale. It's one of the wettest in history in terms of water.
Fair point.
What is he expecting? Coca-Cola? Okay, I'm sorry.
Well, he has no dry wit. Maybe he wanted to be wet. I don't know.
He has no wit. He has nothing. Anyway.
He has no wit.
Except he has nothing except for the designation.
Nothing below the belt, apparently, either.
The designation of the most powerful man in the world, which is frightening.
He's probably not a fun guy, either. That put me off mushrooms.
Yes, he has a mushroom dick.
Oh my God.
When you make a pun, there has to be like
I was being extra subtle.
It's a distance, because when I mentioned
the
character, that was about 20 minutes
ago.
Exactly.
So, anyway, it doesn't matter. But yeah,
you do your humor, I'll do mine.
It's funny. He's a Vietnam vet, and what made me laugh, because we're both authors. Mm-hmm. This guy is against the wishes of his agent. He's doing a Vietnam book, and the title of it, I didn't catch it, but it's so bad, the title. It's like a memoir of a Vietnam vet. Like, it was something really ridiculous, as like a just something as obvious and straightforward. There was no metaphor, there was nothing.
But the point I was trying to make is that, yes, there in the, you know, the height of the Reagan years, when America, you know, a lot of people think was at its strongest, mm-hmm. And the Cold War and whatnot, and you know, we have this Vietnam War that ended really not that long ago, within the last 10 years, and America was wrestling, and a lot of the but the fact they lost that war, and the fact there may even be POW still there and everything, and so movies came like, you know, you're missing action, you're around revisionist history.
It was a tie. What movie is that from?
I don't remember.
It was a tie.
What I'm saying is, with the exception of certain things like the novel Born on the 4th of July, because I don't think the movie had come out, but at this point I think it might have come out maybe the year after that. There was very little that dealt with the psyche of the Vietnam vet. Very little. Some, I think John Voight has a film called Coming Home. I have not seen it, so I can't. But I think this is really one of the first movies, and it was a horror film, to deal with PTSD, which has become such a topic of discussion nowadays. But in the 80s, mid-80s, it really wasn't anything that people really... I don't think it was in the DSM as far as, you know, PTSD for veterans and whatnot. So that's something that this film delved into, which I thought was quite interesting. And, you know, our character is fighting these demons, these Evil Dead 2 type crazy demons, but in many ways, he's fighting metaphorical and literal demons. Because a lot of these demons are representations of things that happened in the war that he feels badly about. I don't want to go too deep into it. I don't want to spoil the big boss, so to speak, and why he's the big boss. And so he's fighting a literal war against these demons and monsters, but he's fighting the metaphorical war inside, which I thought was quite interesting. And even though I don't think this film was wholly successful, that was fairly commendable.
And maybe he's fighting the war against writer's block too. I mean, and it should be noted too that Richard Mole is one of his army buddies, who I was thinking at all of 6'9" and co-star. Yeah, co-star of Night Court.
My favorite.
He would not be someone who'd make a great infantry soldier, let's say. Well, he's a big target.
Another thing that's notable about this movie is that it stars three actors that are more famous for their work on the smaller screen. Of course, you have William Catt from Greatest American Hero. You have Richard Mole, who, of course, even though he was in Night Train of Terror, which is amazing, although in a very different perspective, best known for playing Bull Shannon, the kindly bailiff on Night Court, which I adored. And you also have another, speaking of people you adore, George Wendt, everyone's favorite barfly, Norm himself from Cheers. And he plays the next-door neighbor of Cobb. And there was something else happened in this movie that I thought was very touching. Because when Wendt's character, I wrote it down, can I scan the name or do you know, can you...
Can't say offhand.
I think it was Walter.
Don't know where it went.
Harold Burton.
Okay.
When he starts to get to know his neighbor better and he's realizing that there is that his neighbor, who is a writer that he's a fan of, but is also a man who did a tour in Vietnam, is dealing with things mentally that are somewhat fundamentally disturbing and could lead to something traumatic, he reaches out. He doesn't reach out to Cobb himself. He calls his wife, Sandy. And I thought that was very, very touching. A man actually reaching out to help another man who's in distress mentally. You didn't see much of that in the 80s at all. If anything, it would be the female who would reach out because the man is supposed to be strong and stoic, right?
Yeah.
But here you have a male recognizing a fellow male distress and being empathetic enough and concerned enough to seek help. And I thought that was very touching.
And a little nod to Cheers. He came over with a six-pack and he was like a friendly ear to the obviously troubled Roger Cobb. Yeah, it was quite a terrific character. Like, George Wendt is an interesting fellow. I mean, I was reading up on him, and of course, I used to watch Cheers all the time with my dad, and I read that he was doing a production of Death of a Salesman, where he played Willie Loman, and last year in Waterloo, Ontario.
I thought picture George Wendt as an atypical or archetypical.
That was pretty
atypical. Willie Loman.
Yeah, but I thought like that's an actor's actor, like someone in Waterloo, Ontario, is known for being a tech university hub, but it's not exactly Broadway. So he's doing this small production in a town with like 300,000 or 400,000 people in Ontario, and I thought, whoa, that is amazing. Like, he's consistently worked since he started, and he's always great, whether it's like little spots on SNL, Dub Bears, taking the piss out of the ridiculous Chicago Bears fan base. Mm-hmm. He's so charming and fun and lovable. And he was great, although there's not really that much of a movie going on, but he does what he can to elevate the proceedings.
I wish that, and unfortunately we lost Harry Anderson recently this year. We lost Marshall Warfield.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm sorry, I'm mistaken, we did not. I'm thinking when the original bailiff, who Bull loved so much, who died in real life and they wrote it into the show, The older lady, do you remember that?
I do, yeah.
So we have him, Marsh Warfield, if you're listening, which obviously not, you are alive and well. I just wish Richard Mole was in more stuff. He was such a kindly, gentle giant, figure in my childhood.
And as an ex-magician yourself, Harry Anderson. And another Cheers callback, which is Harry he came hat. In. That was so cool.
Yeah, and he got his, not his start, but maybe his... his fame sort of began in the early days of SNL, where he'd come out as Harry the Hat, the magician. And yeah, so...
I love that. I bet you I can drink this beer that's placed under this hat without touching the hat. And the bar flies go, oh, that's impossible. And he goes, oh, you want to try me? $10. Says, I can do it. Puts the beer under the hat. He ducks his head behind the bar and goes glug, 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 and then says it's gone. And then, of course, the bar flies lift the hat, and then Harry grabs the beer, drinks it without touching the hat. And, of course, that's the stunt. I thought that was so cool. He's a grifter.
Brilliant,
funny,
brilliant.
Funny, like, con man. That was so cool.
So, my mistake for killing off Marshall Warfield, but...
you had an alibi.
But
it's okay.
What happened to these actors? Harry Anderson, before he passed away, you never saw him in anything.
Mm-hmm.
Marshall Warfield, you don't see her in much. John Larroquette, every now and again we do see him. Marky Post, whatever happened to her?
Don't know.
I believe the man's name was Charles Robinson, who played the court clerk.
The black guy, yeah.
Yeah, what happened to him?
Don't know.
This was a wonderful ensemble, and I wish it would... we see Cheers alum all over the place. Some more than others, we don't see much of Rhea Perlman, mm-hmm. let's say. But, I mean, Woody Harrelson has a thriving movie career. Frasier was arguably bigger than Cheers.
Yeah.
Kelsey Grammer appears and stuff.
Wonderful singing voice.
Yeah. And John Ratzenberger is one of the voices of Pixar. He pretty much is a voice in every film, but yet Night Court alum, they seem to have disappeared. But we digress. Let's get back to House.
Well, I mean, you're trying to put it in the context of other films where someone occupies a dwelling place and something untoward happens. So this occupies not the changeling psychological, psychosexual element of, let's say, Burnt Offerings, that heavy-duty atmosphere. This is more video dead. It has that kind of... It's a fun movie with the cheesy effects and a lot of tongue-in-cheek humor. So I'm not sure to what extent it succeeds on that end. I prefer that other style, but I'm not sure how successful this is.
I think if I would have seen, because I've obviously when I got heavily into horror and I devoured everything I can get my hands on, House was something that loomed large and I watched it, but I can't say I've revisited much since before watching it for this podcast, but I can imagine myself in 1986, I would have been 10 years old watching this. And loving every second of it, eating up with a spoon when all that those Evil Dead 2 shenanigans started to happen.
So what did we learn?
Well, House is interesting because, like many horror movies, it spawned a franchise, but it's such a convoluted franchise in the sense that, and this is why I think it was 85, because House 2 came out in 87.
House 2, the second story.
The second story,
yeah,
indeed.
Very clever.
Which, by the way, George Brent was not in it, but who was in it instead? John Ratzenberger.
Ooh, interesting.
Not playing. Okay, so House 2 was unrelated to House 1 in the sense of the characters and whatnot, but it took place and all. And it was oddball, it was zany, it was fun. I think I enjoyed it more than House, the first story. Bill Maher was in it. Bill Maher.
Interesting.
Because before he got politically correct, he was a comedic actor. He was in a movie called, I believe it was Avocado Girls in the Jungle of Death or something like that. So you had Bill Maher, you had John Ratzenberger. I think that was more successful. Now, in 89, there was a film made starring the great Lance Henriksen and the late, great Brian James, who I always appreciate seeing in movies. He always played a heavy. He was a Blade Runner. You'd recognize him as soon as you saw him. It was a real hard horror, and it, again, had nothing to do with a haunted house or House 1 or House 2. It was released in North America it was called The Horror Show, a very literal title, but in the UK and Australia, they released it as House 3. So,
it's like Italian horror style of confusion.
You got it, exactly. So when Arrow Video, and again, kudos to Arrow because I have a Blu-ray copy of House 1 and 2. They call it, they've said, House Two Stories. In North America, it's only the two movies plus a third disc of extras, whereas when it was released in the UK and Australia, it was the three movies. It included House 3, which here we got from Shout Factory as the horror show. Now, the convolution continues because that came out in 89. In 92, a film, because in 92 horror was, when we talked about our Scream podcast, the genre was starting to really suffer. A lot of, there was a lot of declining revenues from these franchises. A lot of them were dying and or dead. And a lot of sequels were going straight to video. So all of a sudden, boom, on the shelf of your local mom and pop or your Blockbuster, there is House 3 everywhere else. But because of the horror show, House 4 in UK and Australia. I know, it's nuts. Now, this was more or less a direct sequel because William Cat was back. What else was he doing?
The Cat came back.
Exactly. The very next day, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It was about 7 or 8 years later. He came back as Roger Cobb. It was sort of a token role. He didn't really do much in it. But at least this was the first sequel that was related to the original. So what did I learn? Just that sometimes when you are following the path of horror sequels, Hellraiser is one of the biggest examples. Oh man, it is not linear at all. You are going on a...
Oh my, it's worse than Demons. Yeah. I learned that this guy favored these ridiculous V-neck sweaters, and it was almost distracting.
You always go to the subject.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
And another thing I learned is that, the cliche of closing a door on an intruder, as if, I swear I've seen 100 movies with that, if not more, where I believe it was in his bedroom, Roger Cobb envisions this creature, a skeletal, desiccated creature that bursts out, and he tries actually to capture it with a bunch of video recording equipment, which is quite funny. But when this thing is coming out, he's like forcing the door closed on it, and the hand is reaching through, and he's, of course, and that is like, I don't know if anyone ever bursts through the door. I don't think so. They always close it on the creature, and then later the creature breaches something. So there's no creature breaching to speak of here, as is in the case. That's
these
a
are
cliche.
Patient creatures.
Oh
like,
my god!
Okay, I'm stuck
like,
in the closet.
Stuck, yeah.
I'll just hang around until the next opportune moment to scare the protagonist.
Now, another thing I learned. Again, this thing went in a different direction. At the beginning, there's this. The beginning, there's a.
Now,
hanging.
When you said went, are you?
Pun? No
or
D.
Went?
No D.
Come on.
And you see this figure swinging and who's committed suicide, and you go, oh, this is going to be one of those movies, but then, nope, they don't do that. And also, they have this. The ant has a bunch of like creepy art. And the ant has this Salvador Dali-esque, melting clocks, all that kind of thing. And these cops come to the house, and they're looking around going, oh, this, who lived here? This is a weird place. And so I thought there would be more of that psychological sense of place injection. And it was more, especially when one of the winged skulls comes flying out. I wrote down, okay, this is the Evil Dead. Jeff's going to love this. He's going to reference Evil Dead. So that's another thing I've learned. Star rating.
Well, yeah, I would love it. But there wasn't enough of those Evil Dead 2 shenanigans for me to go up into the upper echelon of our star ratings, which would be the 4-star, 5-star. However, I did appreciate the PTSD element of it. I appreciated the chemistry between Wendt and Kat. I appreciated... there's a lot I appreciate in this movie, but it wasn't wholly successful. I'm going to begrudgingly give it because I almost feel like it deserves more, but I'm only going to give it 3 stars.
Likewise, and one of these days, speaking of Vietnam movie trauma and PTSD, we keep postponing it. By we, I mean you, because I keep suggesting it and you kibosh it. Although, understandably, because it's a heavy-duty movie, mutual favorite, Combat Shock.
Yeah, it's because when I saw that movie for the first time, it fucking wrecked me. So to you know, I'm not exactly eager to revisit it, although I will revisit it because...
That's weird. Yeah, Taxi Driver, The Deer Hunter, and Combat Shock. There are movies that really wrecked me, and they're all Vietnam related. And well, one of these days it's going to be because it's we both own copies, and love it. It's well, in in this, that certain way, you do love it. I don't know if I love it in a way that I almost don't want to revisit it because it's an intense film.
I can say to you, like, I love Eraserhead, and I do love Eraserhead, but at the same time, my love for it is more of an appreciation for every, and it's not a film that I'm going to put on, like, you know, every 6 months or so just to kind of, you know, as a comfort movie. No, it's a hard movie to watch, right? But when I do watch it, boy, am I'm enthralled. I love it, and we will revisit Combat Shock. We have a lot in the docket, so I'm not going to say it's going to be next week or the week after, but I would say somewhere within 2018. We're getting, you know, we're getting close to the end of the year. We're now in the latter third, let's say. So before the new year, we will do Combat Shock. That is my
promise. Excellent. And yeah, likewise, 3-star, and we promise also to keep bringing you engaging, fun, enlightening genre film chat every Friday.
Witty repartee.
Yeah, well, hopefully.
Yeah.
www.reallyawfulmovies.com. Send us any suggestion, and we will behoove ourselves. No, is that even it? We will, whatever it is. It's been a long day. We will endeavor to cover it and give you a shout out on social media as well.
Again, I'm just going to say, if any movie is suggested, within reason, of course, because, for example, if somebody suggests
Titanic?
Well, I'd almost want to do Titanic just to hear your rip on it. I think that'd be the most entertaining thing ever. But if somebody suggested, let's say, a Sandra Bullock romantic comedy from the mid-90s, no way, right? But, yes, the suggestion box is starting to fill up. So the queue may be a bit longer, but we will get to it. If you suggest something, be patient, and we will get to it.
And we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.